was raining hard in Frisco. I needed one more fare to make my night. A lady up ahead waved to flag me down. She got in at the light. The irony of that song playing on the radio as I opened the Tesla's door, with its weird flat handles, wasn't lost on me. Harry Chapin was one of my desert island artists. If I were stranded somewhere with nothing but sand and my lifelong regrets, I'd want his words echoing through the jungle. Dylan, certainly. But after that, the list gets harder. I slid into the black leather back seat, the slight smell of skunky reefer and black ice drifting from the little pine tree air freshener hanging from the mirror. The driver was a woman in her 50s, black hair pulled into a ponytail that disappeared behind the headrest. She wore sunglasses, despite the storm. "Jack," she asked softly. "Yes," I said. "Hilton, downtown," she said in a knowing tone. "That's right," I replied, reaching for my seatbelt. You see, that information was on the Uber app, but the way she said it made it seem like she was familiar with it. Like I was a regular. "Miserable night," I said. "Works for me. People don't like to walk in the rain, so I'll be busy all night," she replied quickly. "What about you, Jack?" Her reply kind of took me off guard. She used my name like we were friends. "I'm meeting someone tonight for business in the hotel bar." I glanced down at the Uber app and scrolled to the driver's name. "Lisa Madison?" "Nope, no one I know." But she seemed to have a bit of a smile and a friendly tone. "So, how do you like driving?" "Seems like an expensive car to put so many miles on in such a short time," I said, a little quizzically. "Oh, I don't mind. I meet a lot of people, and it pays okay when it's all said and done. What is it you do, Jack?" This time, the word Jack really sounded familiar coming from her mouth. "I'm in communications," I said, the short version. The long version was harder to explain. Years spent reading people for a living, profiling their tells, their habits, their emotional fingerprints. A kind of psychological locksmith. But nobody wants to hear that in an Uber. I'd done other work before that, the kind you don't list on resumes. A military stint tucked behind enough classification stamps to wallpaper the Pentagon. Behavioral analysis. Pattern prediction. The kind of job where one wrong read could get someone killed. And once it did. I kept my eyes on the wet road ahead, lit by the Tesla's high beams, pulsing in rhythm with the wipers. Teslas have a massive display screen, far bigger than I was used to, but it cast just enough light to reveal the silhouette of her face. For a woman who looked to be in her 50s, her features were still classic, unmistakably Mediterranean or Italian. Then the words, "I stashed the bills in my shirt," came through the speakers, and I realized this conversation had taken up the better part of the 6-minute and 44-second song. It was like I'd lost track of time in my head when I heard her say my name. "So, how late do you work?" "My meeting should be over by 10 p.m. I'm going to need a ride back," I said, in a bit of a businesslike tone, not wanting to creep her out. "I can work as late as I wish. What do you have in mind, Jack?" There it was again, the way she said my name, like we'd been friends for years. I looked down at the app again. Lisa Madison. No clue. "Well, I was hoping you could bring me back when I'm done." She chuckled. "The app can't do that, but maybe if you're lucky and I'm nearby in about 2 hours, I'll see it and accept it." Great, because how could I not feel blessed to ride around in a comfortable car with a great sound system playing my favorite music? I replied, "Is that your personal Spotify playlist?" She softly snickered. "Of course it is. You can't hear this music on the radio." As she turned into the hotel drive, I said a bit mournfully, "Very seldom. Very seldom." As I stepped out of the car, I said, "Thank you again for a wonderful ride with great music. Maybe we'll meet again." Just then, these lyrics came out of the speakers. The festival was over, and the boys were all planning for a fall. And out of the darkness, she turned her face, smiled, and said softly, "Maybe." As Bob Dylan's voice filled the air. As I walked into the well-lit lobby of the Hilton Hotel, I felt the shift. Outside was dark and wet, inside, the kind of place where the carpet muffles your steps and the lighting makes you feel like you're on display. The doorman nodded like he knew something I didn't. Maybe he did. Maybe he'd seen enough late-night hotel lobby drama to write his own story. I passed a couple arguing in whispers near the desk, something about a missed reservation and a ruined vacation. Just another Capitol Hill romance. The air smelled like lemon pledge and money. A few middle-aged men in suits stood near the elevators, staring at their phones and typing their thoughts. One guy had a white Bluetooth earplug in his ear and a look that said he'd sell his grandmother for a deal with a congressman. I kept walking by them all, heading to the bar. The bar was just past a row of oversized brown armchairs and couches that looked like the furniture in a man cave from a movie about rich white-collar criminals, designed for senators to sit and talk about government secrets. The bar is called Federal City Bar, which felt about right. Low lighting, old wood, and a bartender who moved like he'd been doing this since Watergate. I took a seat at the far end, away from the lobby sounds, but close enough to watch the show. A TV above the bar played cable news, some panel of well-known pundits pontificating about the day's hearings. I ordered a bourbon, a double. The bartender asked if I wanted to start a tab as I handed him my credit card. When he returned and said, "Here you go, Jack," he just poured like he understood my day. As I took my first sip, I glanced toward the entrance. The rain had slowed, but my anxiety hadn't. I checked my watch. Still time before the meeting. Still time to wonder who Lisa Madison really was. Still time to hear Dylan in my head, singing about the Jack of Hearts. How did I end up here, waiting for someone I'd never met, someone I'd only spoken to once on the phone after a cryptic text said he had something I might find interesting? The voice was calm, almost rehearsed. "Meet me here," he said. "I'll give it to you." I guess I'm a sucker for a story. Or maybe just a mystery. That's the curse of an aspiring writer. You follow the thread, even when you don't know where it leads. James, at least that's what his name tag said, pinned to a crisply pressed shirt, leaned back against the sink, eyes locked on the news playing above the bar. I asked, "You get a lot of political types in here?" He didn't answer right away. Just kept watching, waiting for the host to finish his sentence. Then, like it was nothing, he said, "All the time. House pages, cabinet secretaries, I've served them all." "How long have you been working here?" He smiled, barely. "First day on the job, I poured a drink for James Baker, Reagan's chief of staff. So yeah, I've been behind this bar a while." Then he turned from the screen, looked me in the eye, and said, "Jack, what brings you here?" I wasn't exactly sure how to answer, didn't know who I was meeting or really why. So I said, "Just meeting a friend." James chuckled, glanced back at the TV, and said, "Yeah, we get a lot of those in here, too." It was then that the news anchor cut in, breaking story. A U.S. senator had just been arrested in connection with a security breach at a major financial institution in D.C. Details were scarce. The screen showed a grainy photo, a scrolling cheer-in, and a lot of speculation. James didn't flinch. Just kept watching, like he'd seen this kind of thing before. My eyes were glued to the screen. I didn't notice the clean-cut, middle-aged man in the dark blue Brooks Brothers suit slip into the bar and take a seat by the wall. By the time I saw him, I had no idea how long he'd been there. But he was looking straight at me. James glanced over. "Can I get you something?" The man waved him off, then pointed at me. I picked up the tumbler, took a slow swallow, and walked over to his table. The man didn't move. Just said, "Please be seated." So I was. "Jack," he began, voice calm but deliberate, "I represent a group of investors. We've spent a long time looking for the right person, someone with the skills to solve a particular puzzle. Someone discreet. Someone we can trust." He paused, letting the word settle. "My name is Sherman Adams. I was tasked to find you." I was taken aback, my inner skeptic raising an eyebrow, but ego and curiosity were already leaning forward. So, I asked, "What exactly would you want me to do?" He didn't blink. "First," he said, "you need to understand, this project requires your utmost trust. You can't share the details with anyone outside our group. No exceptions." He leaned in slightly. "Everything I'm about to say is in complete confidence. If you succeed, you'll be compensated handsomely. If not, you'll be expected to never speak of it again. To anyone." I nodded slowly. "What are we talking about in the way of handsomely?" I wanted to know how serious he was and what my silence was worth. He looked me dead in the eye and, in a barely audible voice, said, $1 million. He let the number hang there, then slid a thin envelope across the table. Not thick, just enough paper to ruin a life. And before you say no, he added, you should know we have access to certain sealed materials from your military service. My stomach tightened. There were only a handful of people alive who knew what happened on that operation. Fewer who knew it was my call that sent a man to his death. Sherman watched my face the way a surgeon watches a monitor. We're not here to judge you, Jack. We're here because you're the only one who can do this. For a moment, I wasn't sure if I wanted to bolt for the door or start browsing country real estate. $1 million. To solve a puzzle, something I'd always prided myself on. Mysteries were like oxygen to me, but not the crossword kind. I'd spent years cracking the puzzles people build out of their own psychology. Passwords, habits, tells. People think encryption is math. It isn't. It's personality wearing armor. I'd cracked codes, unraveled plot twists, and helped friends recover forgotten passwords like they were buried treasure. But this felt different. Bigger. And he had my full attention. I asked, "How did you find me?" He smiled, just barely. "Like you," he said, "I'm very good at my job." Then he leaned in, voice low but steady. "Are you in?" I took a deep breath. I imagined what it might feel like to hold $1 million, but the truth was, the number didn't matter. The envelope did. The past did. The mistake I'd buried under a decade of bourbon and busy work did. This wasn't a job. It was a sentence with a chance at parole. I didn't say yes. Not out loud. But the envelope sat there like a loaded gun, and I knew a threat when I saw one. "When do I start?" I asked, because sometimes survival sounds a lot like agreement. He smiled, just enough to register, then reached into his inside breast pocket and pulled out a small black satin bag. He laid it gently on the table between us. I reached for it, but his hand came down, covering it. "Inside this bag," he said, "is an iron key thumb drive. Military-grade encryption. 10 wrong password attempts, and it digitally self-destructs, wipes everything clean." He leaned in, voice dropping half a register. I'm not sure I was crystal clear. "This drive is extremely valuable to my clients. Its safety is paramount." He paused, eyes locked on mine. "Do you understand what I'm telling you?" I nodded. But he wasn't finished. "They have a zero-tolerance policy for mistakes." The bag sat between us like a live wire. I could feel the weight of it already, more than metal and encryption. It was pressure. It was a risk. It was the kind of job that doesn't come with second chances. "How long do I have to get it done?" I asked. He shrugged. "How long will it take you?" 30 days, I said, testing him. He raised an eyebrow. "Then you have 30 days. I nodded, then leaned back. "One more question. Whose thumb drive is it?" "I'll need to know that," I said, "to figure out what they used as a password." He looked up at the TV. A senator in handcuffs was doing the perp walk into the DC police station. Without a word, he lifted his hand off the satin bag. I picked it up and tucked it into my shirt. Jack finished his drink. The bourbon warmed his chest, and he thought, "Next time I'll order off the top shelf," as a smile crept across his face. The bar had thinned out, Bluetooth guy was gone, the armchairs empty, and James was wiping down the counter like he was erasing history. Jack tapped his finger on his phone, pulled up the Uber app, and requested a ride. "Driver arriving, Lisa. ETA, 3 minutes. He stared at the screen. "Lisa? Again?" In a city crawling with drivers, the odds fell off. But the app didn't blink. Just confirmed her arrival. James glanced at the phone, then at Jack. "Looks like you're lucky," he said, voice dry. "Same driver twice in one night? Must be fate." Jack didn't answer. Just nodded, stood, and walked toward the door. The rain had stopped, but the streets still glistened like they were holding secrets. The black Tesla pulled up smoothly, headlights slicing through the mist. Jack reached for the handle, flat, flush, futuristic, and the door opened with a soft click. The radio was playing Simple Twist of Fate. Dylan's voice drifted out like a whisper from the past. He woke up. The room was bare slash. He didn't see her anywhere. Jack froze. That song. That line. It was too on the nose. He slid into the back seat, the leather cool against his jacket. Lisa didn't turn around. Just said, back to the Hilton? Jack nodded. You again. She smiled faintly in the mirror. DC's a small town when it wants to be. He watched her hands on the wheel, steady, deliberate. The sunglasses were gone now, replaced by a calm focus. The pine tree air freshener still swung gently, diffusing black ice and something else sharper. You said earlier the app couldn't guarantee you'd pick me up, Jack said. It can't, she replied. But sometimes things line up. Jack didn't buy it. Not really. But he didn't push. The Tesla glided through the city, past monuments and marble facades, past buildings that held secrets and people who traded them. Jack glanced at the dashboard, no GPS route showing. Just a blank screen and the music. You always drive this car, he asked. Lisa nodded. It's not mine, but it's mine tonight. Jack raised an eyebrow. You work for a company? She paused. You could say that. The song shifted. He felt the heat of the night hit him like a freight train. Jack looked out the window. The city blurred past, but something was sharpening his mind. The bartender. The doorman. The elevator. Lisa. All too smooth. All too familiar. They pulled into the Hilton Drive. Lisa didn't speak. Just looked at him in the mirror and said, "Be careful, Jack." He stepped out, the door closing behind him with a whisper. The Tesla didn't pull away immediately. Just sat there, idling, like it was waiting for something. Inside, the lobby was quiet. The night clerk gave him the same nod, the same smile, as if Jack were a regular or a character in someone else's script. He walked past without a word. The elevator doors opened before he could press the button. His room was lit. Not just lit, prepared. The TV was already tuned to the same channel he'd watched at the bar. The senator was still in cuffs. Still walking. Still not talking. On the desk, he placed the satin pouch with the iron key. But next to it, something new. A bottle of Pappy Van Winkle's Family Reserve 15-year, the kind of bourbon you don't find in hotel minibars unless someone very rich and very deliberate put it there. Jack froze. Not scared. Not yet. But startled. They'd been here. Quickly. Quietly. And they knew his taste. He picked up the bottle and turned it in his hand. The seal was unbroken. The message was clear. Then he saw the note folded, precise, placed like punctuation. 30 days. Starting now. Jack stared at it. Then at the thumb drive. Then at the city outside his window. The Washington Monument shines in the foreground of the Capitol Dome. Both in view. Both watching. He wasn't just in the story anymore. He was the story. He didn't know it yet, but he was already surrounded. Every move is watched. Every coincidence arranged. The investors weren't taking chances. But Jack? Jack was about to start cracking the code. So, where to begin? He picked up the remote and pointed it at the oversized hotel TV. Click. 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 The screen flickered through channels until it landed on the news, same panel, same story, but now the police chief was reading from the indictment. Embezzlement, money laundering, securities fraud, and illicit cryptocurrency transactions. Jack leaned forward. Including unauthorized transfers of Bitcoin and other digital assets tied to offshore accounts. Then came the name. Senator George H. Moses. Independent. New Hampshire. Jack froze. The H. It wasn't just a middle initial. It was a breadcrumb. The clue. The quiet thread Sherman had dangled in the bar. Jack stared at the screen, then at the iron key on the desk. Then back at the bottle of Pappy Van Winkle's 15-year, a bourbon too rare and expensive to be a coincidence. They'd been here. They'd set the stage. And now the curtain was rising. Jack didn't know the whole story yet. But he knew where to start. He sat at the desk, the iron key still untouched, the note 30 days. Starting now, folded like a dare beside it. He opened his laptop, fingers flying across the keys. First stop. Public records. then government databases, ones not meant for public eyes, but accessible through back doors he'd built years ago, mostly for fun. Then came the banking networks, encrypted ledgers, and finally the dark web, where whispers lived and secrets traded hands like currency. He searched George H. Moses. The H kept tugging at him. Military records, Marine Corps, logistics, cyber command. Banking ties, board member at a firm called Hollis Holdings, a boutique investment group with zero public footprint and a lot of private capital. Offshore accounts. Shell companies. One flagged in a leaked Panama file, Hollis Protocol Limited. Jack's pulse quickened. He cross-referenced the shell company with a crypto wallet ID buried in a blockchain ledger from a 2019 breach. The wallet had moved over $2.4 billion in Bitcoin. Quietly. Cleanly. Hollis Protocol. H. It had to be the password. Jack leaned back, grinning. That was easy. He imagined the million-dollar payout. A cabin in Montana. A vintage Stratocaster. Maybe even a bourbon collection that included the bottle sitting next to him. He plugged in the iron key. The screen lit up cold, sterile. Enter the password. Jack typed. Hollis Protocol. He hit enter. The screen blinked. Incorrect password. 9 attempts remaining. Jack froze. The grin faded. He stared at the screen, then at the thumb drive, then at the city outside his window, glowing like a trap. That was supposed to be it. But it wasn't. Incorrect password. 9 attempts remaining. Jack's breath caught. 9. Sherman's voice came back to him, low, deliberate, and cold, zero tolerance. He wasn't talking about the drive. If I failed, the sealed file wouldn't stay sealed. And the people who died because of my mistake wouldn't be the last. Not a metaphor. Not a warning. A policy. Jack's grin vanished. His chest tightened. He looked at the iron key like it might explode. 9 chances. That was it. What happens when you lose a couple of $1 billion of someone else's money? You don't get a refund. You don't get a lawyer. You don't get a second chance. You get erased. Jack stood up, paced once, then sat back down. His fingers hovered over the keyboard, but didn't move. The room felt smaller. The bourbon bottle looked less like a gift and more like a goodbye. He'd been cocky. He'd seen the breadcrumb, Hollis Protocol, and thought he'd cracked it. But now the breadcrumb looked like bait. He glanced at the note again. 30 days. Starting now. But the now was already slipping away, and so was the number of times he could make a mistake. He had 9 chances left. And someone was counting and certainly watching.